objects or corrupted by a high water content. In Changsha, the provincial capital, over half of all stored grain was contaminated. Temperatures in the state granaries were often too high, accelerating the blight, and in turn benefiting the insects, which took advantage of the heat and moisture. In Yunnan, the temperature in some of the granaries reached 39 to 43 degrees Celsius. Even far away from the humidity of subtropical China, in the cold winter of the northern plain, rot was common. Just outside the capital, in the middle of the worst year of famine, well over 50 tons of sweet potatoes decayed in a dozen villages in Yangtze County. A further 6 tons putrefied in storage facilities across the Haidian district in Beijing. Significant losses were also caused by fire, through arson or accident. In Yunnan alone, 70 tons of food went up in smoke each month in 1961. More than 300 tons were completely written off each and every month in 1960, and in 1961 due to blight, insects and fire. The Bureau for Security calculated that the grain lost to fire in 1960 alone in that province would have been sufficient to feed 1.5 million people adequately for a whole month. Yunnan was not the worst offender. In the Anshan region, Liaoning province, 400 tons were destroyed each month in 1960, although this figure included only losses that could be attributed to theft and corruption, a topic we will address later. The transportation system was disastrously affected by the programs of the Great Leap Forward. The railway system was paralyzed by early 1959, overwhelmed by the amount of goods the plan directed from one end of the country to the other. Lorries rapidly ran out of fuel. All over the country, grain was going to waste on railway sidings. In the small provincial capital of Kunming, some 15 tons were lost on trains and lorries each month. But this was nothing compared to what happened in the countryside after the harvest. In Hunan, the entire system seized up in the summer of 1959 because of a shortage of hundreds of freight wagons which were needed every day. Lorries were lacking too, so that only half the grain could be transported from the countryside to the main railway stations. Some 200,000 tons of grain accumulated by the roadside, although only 60,000 tons could be loaded every month. In the end, farmers did not even have enough seed left to plant the crop. Travelling by train from Beijing to Shanghai in early spring 1962, foreign visitors noted that swathes of farmland along the tracks were sparsely planted at best, field after field lying fallow. Across the country, once carefully manicured fields now looked desolate, with clumps of stunted wheat or rice withering for lack of fertilizer. Large plots lay abandoned because the farmers had nothing to plant. Everywhere, vast amounts of seed, normally put aside for sowing in the following season, had been eaten by desperate farmers. Even in Zhejiang, relatively sheltered from the worst effects of the famine, 1 in 5 villages lacked the seed necessary to plant the fields. In subtropical Guangdong, normally ablaze in every shade of green in spring, 10% of the sprouts routinely rotted, the seed weak and impoverished, the land leached of all nutrients. In some communes in Zhongshan County, half the fields wilted, as fledgling plants turned yellow and then slowly decomposed into a brown mush. As the planners directed an ever larger proportion of the farmland to be cultivated with grain, the output in commercial crops and edible oils plummeted. But unlike grain, there was no notion of a subsistence threshold below which the state should not intervene, and procurements soared as a result. Cotton is a good example. We have already noted how textile products from China flooded the international market in 1958, as the country declared a trade offensive by exporting goods at prices below economic cost. The strategy backfired. but exports of textiles nonetheless increased in order to settle the trade agreements entered into with foreign partners. China shipped 1 million meters of cotton cloth to the Soviet Union in 1957, then 2 million meters in 1959, and a huge 149 million meters in 1960. The cost of importing 10,000 tons of raw cotton to feed the textile industries was $8 million. The mathematics was simple. As Finance Minister Li Xianyan exclaimed in November 1961, calculating the equivalent import cost of an extra 50,000 tons of cotton that had been procured from the countryside that year, $40 million is really wonderful. The lure of the greenback was irresistible. Procurements increased from 1.64 million tons in 1957 to 2.1 million tons the following year. Although only half of that amount was levied in 1960 as the cotton crop collapsed, it still meant that between 82 and 90% of the total cotton output ended up in the hands of the state. Take the example of Henan. As the actual output plunged after a peak in 1959, the percentage taken by the state shot up from 80% to 95% in 1960. In 1961, Hunan officials managed to procure more than the total cotton output by fanning out all over the province and sweeping up every bale of cotton, including reserves set aside by teams and communes from the previous crop. This strategy had been adopted by Hebei in 1959 and was highly commended by the leadership. As the State Council explained in February 1959, Hebei had managed to increase its procurements by a third by commandeering reserves found in collective storage facilities and by taking the cotton still in the hands of the masses. The masses were left without much clothing. Just as grain was distributed according to political priorities which favoured the export market above domestic needs, a large proportion of the cotton was fed to the textile industries and sold on the international market. What remained was rationed and distributed in dribs and drabs following a well-established pecking order which placed party and army at the top, followed by the urban population, each of these categories being further fine-tuned into an intricate hierarchy which had one thing in common. The producers of cotton, namely people in the countryside, were generally excluded. Out of the 3.5 million cotton pieces, jian, produced in 1961, about half were reserved for party and army uniforms, and 1 million were put aside for the export market, leaving 800,000 for a population of 600 million. In Guangzhou, ration coupons were required for towels, socks, shirts, vests and raincoats. Cotton cloth was rationed to a metre a year, those living in the suburbs getting one-third less than city dwellers. Before the Great Leap Forward, by contrast, anyone could buy more than 7 metres of cotton a year. By 1960, the situation in the countryside had become so desperate that farmers ate the cotton seeds. In Tsi County, Zhejiang, some 2,000 villagers were poisoned in a single month by eating cakes made of seeds, an indication of the extent of despair reached in one of the most sheltered provinces of China. In Henan, they poisoned over 100,000 people in the region around Xinjiang alone, killing more than 150. Across the land, desperately hungry villagers ate anything they could get their hands on, from leather belts and straw roofs to cotton padding. Spending a month travelling through some of the most devastated regions along the Huai River in September 1961, Hu Yaobang, a party chief and associate of Deng Xiaoping, who would soar to preeminence decades later by steering the country away from orthodox Marxism, reported seeing women and children stark naked. Many families of five or six shared one blanket. It is hard to imagine if you do not see it with your own eyes. There are several places where we should urgently address this issue, to avoid people freezing to death. Throughout the country, those who died of starvation often did so naked, even in the middle of the winter. Although slaughtered in significant quantities during the Great Leap Forward in 1958, over the years, poultry, pigs and cattle mainly succumbed to neglect, hunger, cold and disease. Numbers give a sense of the extent of the devastation. Whereas some 12.7 million pigs were rooting about in 1958, a mere 3.4 million scrawny animals were alive in 1961 in Hunan province. Hubei had 3.8 million pigs in 1961, half of what the province boasted 5 years earlier. A million cattle had also vanished. Shandong lost 50% of its cattle during the famine. Neglect was widespread, as incentives to look after livestock were removed once all the animals had been turned over to the people's communes. In Huaxian, just outside Guangzhou, pigs stood in a foot of excrement. In some villages, the pig sheds were destroyed for fertilizer, leaving the animals exposed to the elements. Routine quarantine measures broke down, as veterinary services lay in disarray. Rinderpest and swine fever spread. Chicken flu was common. The winter exacted the highest toll. Tens of thousands of pigs died of hunger in Cixi County, Zhejiang, in a single winter month. In December 1960 alone, 600,000 pigs died in Hunan province. Even more revealing are the disease rates, which rocketed sharply. In Dongguan, Guangdong, the death rate for pigs was just over 9% in 1956. 3 years later, a quarter of all pigs died, and by 1960, well over half of all pigs perished. The county was left with a million pigs where more than 4.2 million had existed a few years earlier. In Zhejiang, the death rate in some counties was 600%, meaning that for every birth, six pigs died. The entire herd was soon eliminated. In all of Hunan, the situation with livestock was better in 1940, in the middle of the war against Japan, than it was in 1961, according to Zhu Enlai himself. Before the pigs died of hunger, they turned on each other. More often than not, livestock was not segregated by weight, meaning that they were all locked up in a common space where the smaller ones were pushed aside, trampled on, mauled to death, and devoured. In parts of Jiangyin County, for instance, many of the pigs froze to death, but quite a few were cannibalized by larger hogs. When large numbers of pigs are thrown together in a harsh environment, apparently no pecking order develops, and each animal regards all others as its enemy. In Beijing's Red Star Commune, where the death rate for livestock was 45%, villagers noticed that hogs ate piglets, as all were confined together indiscriminately. A small proportion of the deaths were caused by innovations in animal husbandry. Like close cropping and deep ploughing, these were supposed to propel the country past its rivals. All sorts of experiments were carried out to increase the weight of pigs, some of them inspired by the fraudulent theories of Trofim Lysenko. A protege of Stalin, Lysenko rejected genetics and believed that inheritance was shaped by the environment. Lysenko, it might be added, openly expressed his contempt for the Great Leap Forward in 1958, to the great irritation of the leadership in Beijing. Just as seeds of hybrid varieties were developed for greater resistance, hybrid breeding of livestock was envisaged by senior leaders. Jiang Hua, party secretary of Zhejiang, thus asked the county leaders to take steps to actively shape nature. He suggested crossbreeding sows with bulls to produce heavier piglets. Local carders, eager to fulfill impossible quotas for meat delivery, also artificially inseminated animals that had not even reached maturity, including ones weighing a mere 15 kilos. A healthy adult pig should weigh between 100 and 120 kilos. Many of the animals were crippled as a result. Despite a precipitous decline in livestock, state procurements were relentless. In Hubei and Shandong, a ban on the slaughter of animals was imposed in the countryside for a period of 3 months in early 1959. As we have seen, Mao applauded the ban, going so far as to suggest that a resolution be passed that nobody should eat meat. All of it should be exported to honour foreign commitments. Mao did not quite get his way, although the rations for the urban population were slashed several times. Even in Shanghai, a city where on average each person consumed some 20 kilos of meat annually in 1953, a mere 4.5 kilos in ration tickets were allocated by the plan in 1960, although in reality much less was available. But party members continued to receive a regular supply of meat. Guangdong was thus ordered in 1961 to deliver 2,500 pigs to the capital, all earmarked for state banquets and foreign guests. This was in addition to the more regular state procurement quotas. The fishing industry was also badly damaged by collectivization, as the equipment was either confiscated or poorly maintained. In Wuxing, a district of the prosperous silk city of Huzhou, situated on the south of Lake Dai, one in five boats was no longer seaworthy because of insufficient tong oil to repair sprung seams. The number of leaks steadily increased, since the marine nails were no longer being made of forged iron. The overall catch tumbled. On Shaohu Lake, Anhui, a single team of fishermen routinely caught some 215 tons of fish in 1958. 2 years later, no more than 9 tons were hauled aboard, as boats and nets rotted away without any care being taken. Many fishermen abandoned the trade because of lack of incentives. Ploughs, rakes, sickles, hoes, shovels, buckets, baskets, mats, carts and tools of every kind were collectivized. But which collectivity actually owned them? A tug of war began between teams, brigades and communes, with mutual recriminations and random repossessions, the result of which was that in the end nobody really cared. Some villagers would simply throw their ploughs and rakes aside in the field at the end of the day. Whereas in the past a good tool could last up to 10 years, some ploughs managing to survive for 60 years with careful repairs, they no longer lasted for much more than a year or two. A mat used to dry millet, when carefully maintained, might only have to be repaired after 10 years. But with the advent of the people's communes, most were worn out after one season. Some rakes, it was reported by a team of investigators from Shanghai, had to be repaired after a day. And those were the tools that had not been devoured in the backyard furnaces during the frenzied iron and steel movement in 1958. At the Lushan Plenum held in the summer of 1961, Li Yixing, secretary of the South Central Region, told the party leaders that 140,000 tons of farming tools had been thrown into the fires in the model province of Henan. When these losses were tallied with what was destroyed through neglect, the total varied from about a third to half of all equipment. In Shandong, a third of all tools were useless within a year of the Great Leap Forward. In the Shaoguan region, Guangdong, 40% of all necessary equipment was gone by 1961, meaning a loss of some 34 million tools. A third of what was left was broken. The number of water wheels in Hebei was halved, while carts were also reduced by 50%. In Zhejiang province, half of all water pumps, over half of all planting machines, and more than a third of all threshing machines were damaged beyond recovery. Besides the fact that there were few incentives to repair tools that belonged to everybody in general and nobody in particular, other reasons stood in the way of recovery. Widespread shortages of natural resources, especially timber, meant galloping inflation, despite the fixed prices of the planned economy. In Zhejiang, for instance, bamboo was 40% more expensive than before the Great Leap Forward, and the iron allocated to the countryside for tool production was of inferior quality. Their homes already stripped of cooking utensils and agricultural implements to feed the backyard furnaces, the villagers were then handed back useless ingots of brittle iron. Half the metal allocated to villages in Guangdong in 1961 was defective. Tool production in state enterprises, as we shall see, did not fare any better. Chapter 18. Industry. Ever greater output targets were assigned to factories, foundries, workshops, mines, and power plants all over China. How a production unit was rewarded was determined by the percentage of the quota it managed to fulfill. The output total was the magic number that determined the rise and fall of any one factory. And just as carders in the People's Communes pledged ever-increasing amounts of grain, all over the country factories tried to outperform each other in fulfilling the plan. Lists of output figures were broadcast on a daily basis by the propaganda machine, reproduced on chalkboard messages and wall newspapers for everybody to see. Charts and diagrams with growth projections were displayed in factory shops. Photos of model workers were enshrined under glass on a board of honour, while posters, stars, ribbons and slogans adorned the walls of every workshop. Underachievers were identified at factory meetings, while workers who overfulfilled the targets were commended, some of them attending mass meetings in Beijing, reviewed by the chairman himself. Above the hissing molten metal, the clang of crucibles, and the whistling steam, an incessant racket would come from loudspeakers, spewing out propaganda and radio programs to encourage workers to increase production. As the supreme goal of the Red Factory was output, the cost of input was often neglected. In the sprawling bureaucracy in charge of industry, from the central economic ministries to the different administrative departments within the factories, nobody quite managed to keep track of the staggering amount of equipment ordered from abroad. Even Zhou Enlai, who so ruthlessly pressed for the extraction of foodstuffs from the countryside to meet export targets, seemed unable to curb the import of machinery effectively. Enterprises also borrowed money to fund constant expansion, build prestige buildings and purchase more equipment. In the case of the Luoyang Mining Machinery Factory, the monthly interest owed to the bank was equal to the factory's entire wage package. But once installed, the new equipment was subjected to poor maintenance and relentless maltreatment. On a visit to a wharf in Shanghai in 1961, the otherwise sympathetic delegation from East Germany were taken aback by the state in which they found imported machinery. New materials like sheet metal, tubes and profile iron rusted in the open. The iron and steel plant in Wuhan, inaugurated with much fanfare by Mao at the height of the Great Leap Forward in September 1958, gave a similar impression of extreme neglect. A mere 2 out of 6 Siemens Martin furnaces operating at full capacity by 1962. More detailed reports by investigation teams confirmed that materials, tools and machinery were neglected or even deliberately damaged. In the Shizhuang Iron and Steel Company, for instance, half of all engines broke down frequently. A culture of waste developed. In Luoyang, 3 factories alone had accumulated more than 2,500 tons of scrap metal that went nowhere. In Shenyang, sloppy streamlets of molten copper and nickel solutions ran between heaps of scrap metal. Waste developed not only because raw resources and supplies were poorly allocated, but because factory bosses deliberately bent the rules to increase output. the brand new iron and steel plant in Jinan, according to a team of auditors, wasted a fifth of total state investment, or 12.4 million yuan, in its first 2 years, by adding sand to hundreds of tons of manganese ore, resulting in a useless mixture which had to be discarded. As everyone worked feverishly towards higher production levels, mountains of substandard goods accumulated. Many a factory spewed out inferior goods as corners were cut in the relentless pursuit of higher output. The very fabric of material culture was shot through with shoddy goods, from ramshackle housing, rickety buses, wobbly furniture, and faulty electric wiring to flimsy windows. The State Planning Commission found that a mere fifth of all the steel produced in Beijing was first rate. Most was second or third rate, and over 20% was classified as defective. In Henan, more than half of all the steel produced in factories was third rate or worse. Inferior material churned out by the steel-producing giants had a knock-on effect for a whole range of related industries. At Angang, the sprawling steel and iron complex in Anshan, the rails produced in 1957 were generally of first-rate quality, but by 1960, a mere third corresponded to the requisite standards. As the quality of the rails suffered, several sections of the railway network became too dangerous for heavy traffic and had to be closed down. A few collapsed altogether. Not only did the quantity of inferior goods increase, but larger proportions of them found their way into society. In Henan, only 0.25% of the cement, which did not fulfill production criteria, actually left the premises in 1957. This ballooned to over 5% in 1960, as large quantities of substandard material were used on building sites. A survey of a whole series of industries in Kaifeng, Henan, reached an even more astounding conclusion. More than 70% of all the output consisted of reject products. And just as faulty rails, warped beams, and fake cement perilously weakened the material structure of everyday life, inferior consumer goods became part and parcel of socialist culture. In Shanghai, clocks sounded the alarm at random. Enamel basins were sold with splits and bubbles on the surface, while half of all knitwear and cotton goods were defective. In Wuhan, zips jammed, knives bent, and blades broke off the handles of agricultural tools. Sometimes factories cut costs by churning out products without any identifying label. This was the case with a fifth of the tinned meat sold in Beijing. Sometimes the labels were wrong, for instance when fruit was substituted for pork, leading to large amounts of rotten goods. Even more worrying were problems caused by the addition of chemicals to processed food. In 1 year, a Beijing dye factory sold 120 tons of harmful pigments specifically designed as food additives. Many of these were banned, for instance, Sudan yellow, a dye used in inks. Lax procedures over quality control also meant that contaminated food and medicine were allowed to leave the factory floor, one example being a batch of 78 million bottles of penicillin gone bad. A third was sent out from a Shanghai factory before the problem was even spotted. Mao scoffed at the very notion of a defective product. There is no such thing as a reject product. One man's reject is another man's grain. Mao may have dismissed concerns about quality, but a reject culture damaged the country's reputation on the international market. As we have seen, the cost of making good on the leaky batteries, contaminated eggs, infected meat, fake coal and other tainted merchandise delivered in 1959 alone amounted to 200 or 300 million yuan. But reject culture also corrupted the inner workings of military industry. As a report by Marshal He Long showed, it was not only assault rifles that failed to fire, but also 19 jet fighters produced in Shenyang that were substandard. In Factory 908, well over 100,000 gas masks were unusable. Ni Rengjun, who ran the nuclear weapons program, in turn complained about the poor quality of wireless devices and measuring gauges,